This is my third opportunity to be with this church in a gospel meeting, but it's been some time since I've been here. There have obviously a lot of changes since the last time I was here, and I'm glad to see your good growth and your good continued progress as you seek to do the Lord's work in this community. Sure joy to be with you, and look forward to the week and the time we'll have each evening to study God's Word together. I hope at the end we can say that we have done good and that God has been glorified because of what we've tried to do here this week. In Luke chapter 21, you have Luke's harmony of what Matthew 24 we're more familiar with, of the destruction of Jerusalem. I want to spend some time in this text, not talking about the destruction of Jerusalem proper so much, as talking about some things that we can learn from the crisis that these people of God in Jerusalem face. Maybe rather a conspicuous timing, given the storms and things that have threatened our beloved state here the last day or two. But you folks escaped rather unscathed, it seems to me. I left Dallas at 6:45 yesterday morning. It doesn't take that long to get here. But I want to make sure I got out of Dallas before anything hit up there. And so I went to Temple where my daughter and her children are at and spent a good part of the day with them before coming down. And as I got down here, I thought, you wouldn't even know there's a storm in the state of Texas coming down to this part. But some of our good folks, as our brothers just prayed, have undergone some rather hard times. And the point I mentioned about that is it doesn't matter what the crisis is. Surviving a crisis, the principles of how you survive a crisis are the same. And so we'll look at some things that happened in the life of these people in Luke chapter 21. The Lord talks about the destruction of Jerusalem to also prepare ourselves for when crises come in our lives. And so if you begin reading with me in Luke chapter 21 in verse 10, he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes in various places, famines, pestilences. There will be fearful sights, great signs from heaven, but before all these things they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to synagogues and prisons, and you'll be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. But it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony." Now when he begins here in verses 10 through 13, introducing what is going to take place, understand what he begins to talk about are things that are observable in our world in all times. There's never been a time in the history of man in which there have not been things like earthquakes in various places, famines, and pestilences. We hear about them all the time. In fact, it was interesting during the Olympics that just took place, just prior to that, and going on while the Olympics were being celebrated in Beijing, there were earthquakes that had taken place in China. There are famines that are taking place. There are pestilences that always beset people under God's creation. And there's never been a time in which there's not been nation that has risen up against nation. We have a rather idyllic dream about world peace that has never been a part of any history of mankind that's ever been recorded. But what he talks about is, these are things that are taking place, that are going on round about you. Occasionally, you may have some disaster that strikes you personally, but in the main, these are things that go on round about us in our world all the time, but that never really touch us. And occasionally you'll have a reminder of the power of God's creation when you have a hurricane that threatens our Gulf Coast, like we've just witnessed in our state, that all of us are too aware of. But those are things that occasionally touch us. They don't intensely touch us, generally speaking. Now it's intensely touching this morning if you're without electricity, as my son and his family are in Lufkin. But in the main, famines, pestilence, earthquakes, nations against nations, all these things go on round about us. Those of a prognosticating bent tell us that when they see these things happen, what this means is this is the end time coming. Well, Luke 21 is not about the end time. Matthew 24, that harmonies with this, is not about the end time. He's warning them about the destruction of Jerusalem that's about to take place. But he says, this is not the thing that's going to happen. These are just things that go on round about you. So just observe them. So we'll come then to verse 14 and say, therefore, in view of everything that goes on round about you, sometimes touches you, most of the time does not touch you. Therefore, he says, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer. The first thing that you need to do to prepare for a crisis is to settle beforehand, before the crisis comes, what you will do. Now, I know the language is a little confusing here in verse 14 because he says, settle in your hearts not to meditate beforehand what you will do, is the same language that you see in Matthew chapter 6, take no thought for the morrow. In other words, don't be anxious for the moment, is what he's saying. That's what he's saying of when the crisis comes, don't spend your time meditating and fretting what you're going to do. Don't be anxious for the moment. Settle in your heart beforehand what you will do. If that's not the case, then he's just contradicted himself because he says, settle in your heart. Then he says, don't settle in your heart. So he says here, settle in your heart. Don't be anxious about it. Don't fret about it. Don't worry what you're going to do. The fact of the matter is, being people of God, we have to be people who have determined in our heart before a crisis comes what we will do in the crisis. A couple of illustrations about that. Genesis chapter 39. You go to the events in the life of Joseph when he is in the house of Potiphar. And you come to the time in which the house is conspicuously absent of everybody but Joseph and Mama Potiphar. And Mama Potiphar decides that Joseph is a good-looking young fellow, and therefore she wants to go about trying to seduce him. Joseph, determining what's taking place, flees, leaving circumstantial evidence in her hands. He has no defense against himself. But his response to her before he flees is, how can I do this thing and sin against God? He didn't just decide in that moment what he was going to do. That had already been determined beforehand. Second illustration, Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8. Daniel, somewhere between the ages of 14 and 16 years old, is suggested, away from his home, away from his parents, away from anybody that would impose restraints upon him, said he purposed in his heart beforehand he would not eat the king's meat or drink the king's drink. Here at an amazing young age, he has determined beforehand what he will do or what he will not do. And on this occasion, he determines he's not going to eat the king's meat or drink the king's drink. And the fact is, when a crisis comes, if we don't have settled beforehand what we will do, we're going to make a decision. But it will not be a decision that is a byproduct of reason and a byproduct of thought. It will be a decision that is a byproduct of emotion. We will decide, and 99.9% of the time, we will decide wrong in the moment of emotion, not right. The fact of the matter is, Christians are people who have some things settled beforehand, what they will do. Here he's giving a warning about things that are going on round about them. But now then he says, therefore, settle in your heart beforehand not to meditate, for I'll give you a mouth, and wisdom with all your adversaries will not be able to contradict you. Here there are going to be people like the magistrates, like the civil government, people in whom you put your trust and confidence to perform and execute justice equitably. But here they're going to haul you before the magistrates. They're going to touch you. It's people in whom you put trust to keep civil order, but they betray you. Determine in your heart beforehand what you will do. It goes from a general population of things that generally don't touch you to now the intensity goes up a little bit in which now it touches you by people who betray you and who are confident and in whom you have placed confidence. as Christians, we don't have to wait till a moment comes to determine whether we're going to tell the truth or lie or not. As Christians, and I wish we could get young people to understand this, you don't have to wait until hormones are raging, passion is hot, and you find yourself in the back seat of a car, what you will do. You have to make up your mind beforehand that you're not going to put yourself in that position. We have to be people who determine beforehand the kind of people we're going to be. Married people don't have to determine before, don't have to wait until the moment comes to decide to compromise their marital vows to determine whether they're going to commit adultery or fornication or not. There are people who determine beforehand they're not going to put themselves in that compromising situation. But if you wait till the moment comes to determine what you're going to do, I can tell you what you will decide. And what you decide will be wrong to do. Sunday morning comes. The alarm rings. You don't have to determine beforehand what you're going to do. You don't have to wait till that moment to determine what you're going to do because you settled it beforehand what you will do. Years ago, I lived in Del Rio. We lived there from 1981 to 1988. 7 good years of our life. 7 challenging years in a lot of ways of our life, but 7 good years of our life. Those are good people there. They loved us. They took us in a time in our life in which we needed that kind of influence. But I remember while we lived out there, a rather strange anomaly took place. People can appreciate this, being South Central kind of Texas people. Del Rio being as far southwest in the state as you can go, it's not normal that you get ice and snow in that part of the town, in that part of the state. I mean, it's known for its aridness, although the lake out there has changed the climatic atmosphere out there. And it's known for not getting a lot of threatening weather, generally speaking. Well, one night we went to bed and the ground was absolutely clear. The next morning we woke up and literally, this is not just a preacher's story, this is true. There was 9 inches of snow on the ground. Now the house where we lived was right up next to the church building. In fact, the classroom wing there was part of our backyard fence. Well, I had no doubt that Jody and the kids and I could make it to the building because we could just walk through the snow. I cleared a path for us to get through, get to the back gate and get to the building. But I thought, well, there's not going to be anybody able to show up because you got 9 inches of snow on the ground. And furthermore, 25% of the church lived 25 to 35 miles out of town. And I thought, well, we won't see the whites of their eyes today. And then the phone rang, and it was Bill Burke, who was one of the backbone members, and he said, Ricky, Arlene, and I can't make it this morning. We left our car out. They had a Volkswagen Rabbit, and the doors were frozen shut. He said, I can't get the doors open to get the car started. I thought, well, if Bill can't make it, nobody's going to make it. Well, we went over to the building, and here came two ladies, a mother and daughter, grown women, Annabelle and Marie make it. And I thought, well, bless their hearts. They got out, and they drove in this, and they're here, but it may just be us and Annabelle and Marie. In just a moment, here came a forerunner full of those people that live 25 miles out of town. Sam McBee had a four-wheel drive Forerunner, and what he had done is he had made the route out there and picked up everybody he could get in his four-wheel drive, and they make it in to town for assembly, for worship. In just a little bit, here comes Bill and Arlene Burke. Bill had gone back out, worked on the car door, finally got it open, got that rabbit started, and they crawled to the building. Now, those people just didn't make up their mind that morning what they were going to do. They'd already had it settled in their heart what they were going to do beforehand. And when the crisis came, it wasn't a matter of if they were going to do it. It was a matter of how they were going to get it done. In 1 Peter chapter 5, First Peter chapter 5 and verse 10. He said, but may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you've suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and here it is, settle you. Settle in your heart beforehand what you will answer. In the beginning, before the crisis, during the crisis, and at the end of the crisis, may the Lord perfect, strengthen, establish, and settle you. Christians are people who've settled in their heart beforehand what they will do. Second principle, verse 16 through 19. You'll be betrayed even by friends, by parents, brothers, relatives, friends, and they will send some of you to your death. And you'll be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head will be lost. In your patience, possess your souls. Now, first of all, notice the progression of things here. There are things that are going on around about you that are in this world, that have always been in this world, that are part of this world, but generally do not touch us. But then it begins to touch us a little bit by those who betray us, in whom we've placed our confidence and trust to adjudicate equitably justice. We can live with that. It's not comfortable. It's an annoyance. But now then, it intensifies one grade further. He says, now then, we are betrayed not by the world events, not by civil authorities, but now betrayed by who? By parents, by brothers, by relatives, by friends. If we've placed our confidence and trust in civil authorities to keep order and to adjudicate law fairly, we for sure have put our confidence in our parents, our brothers, our relatives, and our friends to be able to, as my son used to say in high school years ago, watch our back. We depend upon them to really shoot straight with us and to keep a confidence. But here now he says, they betray us. How are you going to survive when betrayal comes at the hands of those who you trust the most intimately? He says in verse 19, in patience, possess your souls. Now patience is an interesting word. It's a word we talk a lot about. But it's a word that goes when there is a wait to be born. There's an adversity to be endured. Patience always has the wind in your face, not the wind in your back. There's some load. There's some burden to bear up. There's something that is afflicting you, that is something that is pressing you down. And he says, in patience, you bear up. There's also a time factor associated with it. You know, 2 seconds on a stove that's cool may not be a long time. But 2 seconds with your hand on a stove that's white hot may be a long time. I'm the kind of fella who can stand pain long as I can't feel it, and I'm not exaggerating that. I'm not a fella who doesn't go to the doctor. The first sign of pain, I'm going, give me the Vicodin, my best friend. Hey, I'm not a natural birth kind of fella. I'm walking in, if I'm having the baby, they're putting the epidural in on the way in. I'm not waiting till the contractions start. I don't want to feel those things. Here, patience says there's not only a burden to be borne, but there's something to be endured. And what he's saying is, in patience possess your souls. It looks at the marathon of life, doesn't look at the sprint of life. A lot of people live their life in one gust of a sprint. But as Christians, we are involved in the most arduous event of life, that is the marathon of faith. And a lot of people have their moment of glory in one grand burst. But like a house of fire, soon burn out. But he says, as Christians, we're involved in a marathon event. And in order to endure that marathon, you're going to have to endure with patience and possess your souls with patience. Turning back into Luke chapter 8, Luke chapter 8, verse 11. Luke, in his harmony here of the parable of the sower. Notice in verse 15, rather, than verse 11, verse 15, he said, "But the ones that fell on good ground are those who, having heard the word with a noble and good heart, keep it, and notice, bear forth fruit with patience." We want to convert people instantly. Someone walks into our door, before they leave, we instantly want to convert them. Now, I love the passion that goes with wanting to convert people, but people aren't converted instantly. He said, you bear forth fruit with patience. But we are an instantaneous microwave society. We are instaholics. We don't bear forth pain with patience well. We don't bear well with patience. When I was growing up, if we wanted popcorn, Mom had a copper bottom pan that she'd put on the stove, get the oil hot in the pan, and then pour the popcorn in, put the lid on there, and begin to shake it. Can you imagine popping popcorn that way today? Well, things improved about mid-youth. We came out with Jiffy Pop. Then you could do away with the oil and the mess of the oil, because it was all in foil, already prepared for you. You put the Jiffy Pop on, you just began to shake it, and it was ready a whole lot sooner. It was a whole lot better. Well, then we got even better than that. We came out with Hot Air Pop. Now there's no grease. And now it's a whole lot quicker. I mean, you just put it in, it just pops right out, just like in the picture show. But we got even better than that. Now we have microwave popcorn. And on the back of the package, it will tell you, if it's a full-size package, 2.5 to 3 minutes will have it ready for you. I'm telling you, if you do it 3 minutes, you've got burnt popcorn. 2:15 is about right. We like things instantly. And we want instant fruit. But he says, you bear forth fruit with patience. Look in Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2. Look at verse 6. He says, who will render to each according to his deeds eternal life to those who by patient continuance in doing good seek for glory, honor, and immortality. Those who seek for glory, honor, and immortality do what? Endure through patient endurance. The fact of the matter is, we're going to face a number of trials in this life, and those trials may not be over a lifetime. There may be trials that we have to patiently endure through our life. But we as God's people have not been raised in a hothouse. We as God's people have not been raised as tender suckling plants. We've been conditioned by the hard circumstances of life and understand what it is to patiently endure. When I was a boy growing up living in Denton, Texas, when my dad was preaching there, the house that we lived in had a dent area that had been added on to the existing house. Along the back wall of that house, there were windows all the way across, with the exception of the door exiting to the backyard. My dad is a fervent gardener, still is to this day. Dad had his garden in the backyard, but every seed planting time of the year, Dad also is very frugal. You think you can't squeeze blood out of a turnip, my dad can do that. Of course, that's why we also go to him for loans sometimes too. But nonetheless, that's a different story. But Dad, what Dad would do is he had his little cartons that he had bought tomato plants in, he had saved them. And so over time, what he collected enough of those that he just began to do his own. So he'd prepare his little preparation soil and put the seeds in there. And then the whole windowsill along the back would have tomato plant settings all the way across the windowsills. And you could see the little tomato plants come up and begin to grow. Well, the time came in which it was time to put them in the garden. So Dad put them in the garden, but then around them, Dad's frugality also saved the half garden, the half gallon plastic carton milk containers. You know, the kind where you can cut the bottom out and you can open the top And then you can close the top. I know I'm dating myself here. What Dad would do is he'd cut the bottom out and he'd set that over the tender plant and leave the top open. He'd watch the weather at night to see if the weather was going to be good, if it's going to be cold, going to be harsh, if it's going to be a threat of ice or harsh weather. He'd go and he'd close the tops. And in the mornings, he'd go and he'd open them back up. Now, if you've gardened at all, you also know inevitably in gardening that there are volunteer tomato plants that come up every year. Interesting thing about that was, those volunteer tomato plants, Dad never set the cartons around them. He never protected them. He protected the tender sucklings. Why? Because they had not been acclimated to the environment. They could not endure the harshness of the environment. Those who had grown up as volunteers, he never protected because their stalks had been toughened to be able to endure the harshness of the climate and the environment. But we as God's people have not been raised in a hothouse. We've not been hedged about. We've not been protected. This is a very harsh world. It's a very hard world. And we have been toughened through the circumstances of this world. But we endure with patience, possessing our souls. Third principle. Begin in verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then you know that its desolation is near. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. Let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant, to those who are nursing babies in those days. For there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. They'll fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. There'll be signs in the sun, the moon, the stars, and on the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the seas, the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them from fear and the expectation of those things which are coming on earth, for the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then they'll see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now when these things begin to happen, look up, lift up your head, because your redemption draws near. Now once you see the progression of things. First of all, you have the world events that are going on round about you. Then things become a little more personal. Civil authorities betray you. But then they become more intensely personal, because people in whom you have the greatest confidence and trust betray you. But it gets worse. Notice he will say, verse 26, men's hearts failing them from fear and expectation of those things coming upon them. Now it's not just family and friends betraying. Now it's not just civil authorities betraying. Now it's not just things in the world going around about you. Now it is that man betrays himself. His own heart fails. And those are the circumstances that he talks about here. When you see these things, he says, number one, flee to the mountains. Language that is used throughout the prophets consistently. For example, in the book of Habakkuk. He will talk about in chapter 3 how they will flee to the mountain, and as a deer will escape, that is, deer lives in the mountain standing on its hind legs, will escape things that are going on below. Why? Because in the mountains are safety. In the mountains you live above all the fray, all the difficulties that are taking place. The point Habakkuk is making about that is, my faith will sustain me and will enable me to live above all the difficulties that are taking place. So first of all, he uses language the prophets use to say, flee to the mountains. Second of all, he says, it's best that there be nothing that prolongs you. That slows you down from that escape. And in doing that, he said it'd be best that you, number one, not be pregnant with child, and number two, that you not be nursing a child. Now, he's not giving a commentary against pregnancy. He's not giving a commentary against breastfeeding. But he's just saying those are things that are things that weight you down and slow you down in your exodus. When the storm warning comes, you want to be able to escape rapidly the storm. But he says, there are some who didn't heed the warning. Isn't that always the case? I mean, you get this warning that comes from the National Weather Center. This hurricane's coming. It's going to be a bad thing. Get off. Get out of here. Prepare yourself. Exit now. Turn all the highways. Go in the opposite direction. Get everybody out. Get out of harm's way. And 40% of the people, 40% of the people stay, and then expect the rescue people to put their life on the line to come rescue them because it's something that happened they didn't think was going to happen because they didn't believe the report. Skepticism reigns. Even then it was the case. Well, the problem was, here Titus and the Roman armies begin to descend on the city. And Josephus talks about this event in which one day the gates of the city blew open. Now, the gates of the city weren't these little hollow corridors like you have at the back here, where if this wall were exposed, wind would be able to blow these doors open at will. These were huge, humongous gates that took multiple men to be able to close and open every occasion that occurred for that to happen. But the gates blew open. The armies came. One group of people saw the armies coming and they said, "Oh, this is the blessing of God that is coming." Another group of people looked and said, "No, this is the judgment of God that's coming." Those who saw the gates open thinking the blessings of God were coming, and Titus and his Roman soldiers came and just mowed the city down, some 1 to 2 million people were exterminated that day, looked up and said, "Wait a minute, this isn't what we thought was going to take place." And their hearts failed them. Two different groups of people, same circumstance. What's the difference? Is one group of people dumber than the other? No. One group of people was prepared for what was going to take place. The other group of people were not prepared for what was going to take place. One group of people looked up and said, "Yes, this is what the Lord has said was going to happen." And they said, "Now is the day of our salvation." Another group of people said, "Yes, look up, this will be the day of our deliverance." And it was the day of their judgment, and their hearts failed them. When the Lord warns us that He's going to come again, and He comes again, we should look up and say, "Oh, I didn't know it was going to come." It's that we've been looking for Him to come all along. We're not taken by surprise in that. When the storm surge comes and houses are washed away along low-lying areas that have always been swamps, and man coming in and build them is not going to change them from being a swamp. They're going to revert to being a swamp all over again. Don't be surprised. When it's over, you have a trail of rubble that is left. Here the Lord warns them, but why does one group fail? Because their hearts fail. In fact, He will go on and say, verse 29, "And He spoke to them a parable and said, 'Look, the fig tree and all the trees, when they are ready, budding, you see and you know for yourself, the summer's now near. So you likewise, when you see these things happening, know the kingdom of God is near.' And He says, 'As surely I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all things are fulfilled. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away.'" He said, "How is it that you can see a mesquite tree budding, and you know from a mesquite tree budding the season's changing?" And that goes over my generation's head and younger. I was talking to my dad here a while back, and those of his age, 81, maybe a little bit younger than that, can appreciate the analogy a little bit better than my generation and younger can. But Dad understood something. When the mesquite tree begins to bud, you know the winter's over. You know spring's coming. There's something about the way God made mesquite trees. They don't lie. They know what it is. But if you can see, and you know the signs of the changing of the seasons, but you can't heed this, why? Because you're not looking in the right place. But He says, "I'm going to tell you. This is certain. Mark it down. It's going to happen. My word will not fail." Fifth principle, He will say, verse 34. "But take heed to yourself, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousings, drunkenness, cares of life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, Pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Here you have all these things that are going on in this world. People are doing what they normally do. You've got a wedding going on. You've got a funeral going on. You've got a party going on. You've got mourning going on. But he said, there are two things additionally that you must do. Number one, you must watch and pray. Watch is a term for a sentinel. It's a term that is associated with the military, in which the sentinel is set to watch for the adversary. We have our watch posts all over this world. We have our monitors that we have, that we're listening to everything that's going on through satellite about what's taking place. And the sentinel cannot turn his back. The sentinel cannot close his eyes. The sentinel cannot sleep while it posts. And so what he says is you have to be ever vigilant, to be on guard and be ever watchful. A part of the soldier preparing himself for offensive battle in Ephesians chapter 6 was to be watchful and to pray. But it does no good to get that soldier dressed in the Roman armament if he's not going to be ready to watch and to do battle. And then finally he will say, you need to pray. Of all people who ought to appreciate the value of prayer in our lives, it ought to be God's people. Maybe this is an observation that is born of cynicism. I hope it's not. I hope it's an observation that is a sad commentary rather than cynicism. But it seems to me that the people who have the hardest time understanding the value of prayer in their lives are people who are God's people. Because what we want to do is we want to qualify everything about what we can do and what we can't pray for. I've got to tell you, and you're free to disagree with me about this, I'm not trying to be dogmatic, but I've not found an exception to anything in prayer. Everything's on the table. Everything's available. But what we want to do is we want to qualify, we want to argue about what we can pray for and everything that goes with that. But what he says here is you pray. And I tell you the strange thing about that is people in the world who may not have a relationship with God, who may not know the difference from Genesis to Revelation, and you see these people coming back in on this Gulf Coast, and they come in and they see their home gone. I'll tell you what they will say. They say, well, we still are alive, and after all, we can pray. How is it that people who've been through a hurricane, who've been through a tornado, who've been through a storm, who have everything they have in a physical possession wiped away, understands one thing, they can pray to God. But here we are as God's people, and because we are afraid of being identified as somebody who's charismatic, we won't go anywhere close to that. We'll go to everybody else before we go to God. When God is our first resource. But when life is on the line, when life is challenged, when the crisis comes, it is to God we go. It is to Him we pray. Not last, but first. And I tell you, usually when life is on the line and the last breath is drawing near, everything that is stripped of any vestige of concern about being viewed otherwise is laid aside, because we understand intimately at that moment it is between us and God, and it's to God we go in prayer. If you want to survive in a crisis, it doesn't matter what the crisis is, settle in your heart beforehand what you will do. Impatience possess your souls. Don't let your heart betray yourself. Watch and pray and be prepared for the coming crisis. Life will throw its curves at you. Crises will come. The fact of the matter is, if you've not had a crisis in life, it's just because you haven't lived very long. Because if you live long, they will come. If someone doesn't do it to you, your own body will do it to you. It will fail as age approaches. Well, you've listened well, and I thank you, and I hope this has been beneficial to you. Thanks.
Thank you for the class.